Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and, you know, today's show, we're going to focus on a very disturbing trend in American life, but especially on political campaigns. It's the purposeful use of disinformation or lies to manipulate voting decisions. I feel this way now, and I bet a lot of you out there listening do as well. How do we as citizens know what to believe anymore? And especially things that are purposely used to deceive us. My guest today is going to try to answer that question for us. He's written a new book on this very topic. Very good timing for the election coming up. He's my friend and colleague, Sasha Eisenberg. Sasha and I know each other going way back. He wrote just an outstanding book called The Victory Lab, which I could talk about all day, which he appeared on this show before to talk about. And now he's got a new book out that I think is going to be very interesting. It's called The Lie Detectives: In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age. Sasha, thank you for taking the time today.
Oh, always great to be with you, Robin. I really appreciate it.
You know, we've had candidates not tell the truth, I'll say it in nice terms, going back to the beginning of the country. What's different now that makes this a more serious concern and a threat to our democracy? I don't think that's overstating it.
Yeah, the threat to our democracy, I think, is in part that we have a weakening of a lot of the institutions that once helped guide citizens towards some shared understanding of truth on basic facts. And so just about every institution that, I'm 43 years old now, I guess I'll just say for the sake of when I was born, every institution that sort of played a role like that, we're talking about media institutions, we're talking about academic institutions, scientific expertise, government institutions, the courts, the FBI, public health agencies, religious institutions, they were all stronger than they are now. They're a weaker presence in American life. And I think that has made it easier for lies and conspiracy theories to take hold. The particular challenge for the political campaigns, and here I mean candidates, party committees, super PACs, labor unions, is yes, there have always been people who there was always a good chance that your opponent could be lying in politics. That is not new. I do think that candidates were typically less brazen than they are willing to be now. I think there was thought to be real reputational cost to being called a liar. I think that the Trump years, frankly, has like devalued that term, which is why we used to joke about how, you know, a politician's answer would be the type of thing that was technically correct, but obviously misleading because they really didn't want to actually be called a liar because there were reputational costs. You were afraid that voters might turn away from you. You'd be afraid that donors might be less interested in giving you money, that if you were in a legislative body, your colleagues would not really want to work with you if you're seen as a liar. I think a lot of that has changed. The big thing for campaigns, though, is that there are all these people who now, all these people, institutions who have the ability to communicate with voters at scale and speed, who are not sort of part of the traditional political process, who aren't regulated by the FEC, who don't have to report their spending to the IRS, who aren't constrained by many of the traditional limits that political communicators abided by. And so now you're in an environment, if you're candidate or a party, your opposition isn't necessarily your opponent. It could be somebody in their basement who's anonymous. It could be an online mob who has no clear leader. It could be a foreign intelligence service. It could be some people who are just trying to make money off of advertising clicks, but don't really care which candidate their content helps or hurts. And so how do you respond to that? How do you decide which of those lies are worth addressing and how you go to voters to correct them when calling your, you can't just try to tell the voters that your opponent is being a liar?
This seems to be directly tied to the rise of social media and the decline of small town newspapers and not even small town newspapers anymore. I mean, I remember growing up, and I'm 65. You had the local papers were run by people who were pretty objective. And if they said something, you knew it was pretty true. But we don't have those anymore. And we depend on social media. As you said, those are oftentimes people that you don't even know who they are spreading information.
Yeah, no, I think the weakening of media institutions across American life, and I think this is obviously particularly pronounced in outside of big cities, but even big city newspapers don't have the reach or influence that they once did. And so, you know, what it's done is it sort of created a void where information is reaching voters from speakers who aren't necessarily credible, who might have partisan or ideological motivations for telling people something. And those are in many places, but geographically and otherwise, you know, the most effective communicators online are often people who are not motivated by partisan goals, but unaccountable. I think that's the bigger difference. Is it's like if an established political interest, and they lied too, right? So if the Farm Bureau is lying about or misrepresenting your record on ag subsidies, and you're a politician, you could come out and try to hold the Farm Bureau accountable. But we're talking about people who are accountable sort of to nobody in our political process, and they have the ability to reach numbers of voters at a speed which was unimaginable even 15 years ago.
Yeah. This has spawned kind of a new industry within political consulting. And if you want to know more about political consulting, the role of consultants in campaigns, go back to the Victory Lab and get Sasha's book there. But this has spawned, which was really interesting to me, a whole new effort on behalf of campaigns. And there's a local angle too, because our former Congresswoman Sherry Bustos was a part of this recently, but you might talk about that a little bit as well.
Yeah. So she was the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee after the 2018 elections, up through the 2020 cycle. And so in that role, it meant that she was responsible for helping both Democratic members of Congress who were running for re-election, and especially in competitive districts, and challengers, for open seats in places around the country where Democrats in Washington thought they stood a good chance to win a seat. And the Congressional Campaign Committee is a little different than the Senate Campaign Committee or the Governor's Association, because House campaigns are just much smaller. They're smaller in terms of their budgets, their staff size. They tend not to have the same number of sort of specialized consultants. You go to a Senate race and they have a research director and a digital director and, you know, several communications staffers and press secretaries. You get to a House race and often it's just a handful of people who are doing a number of things, and they hardly ever have somebody who's just focused on digital communications, for example. And so when Congresswoman Bustos comes into this role, Democrats are still sort of reckoning with the reasons that they lost in 2016. And one of the things that people in the party have sort of alighted on as a cause is the way that the party had failed to understand the new communications environment. And that included how to address, track and address disinformation online. So she creates a counter disinformation task force leading up to the 2020 elections. And it is sort of the first time that a party committee has created, you know, a team whose job it is solely to track, measure, anticipate, and probably most importantly, train candidates and staffers on the ground around the country and how to make smart decisions about this. One of the big challenges that that the sort of principal figures in this book are dealing with, especially in the years since 2016, is how and when to respond. And sort of political communicators in the generation I wrote about in that last book, Robin, there was a sort of shorthand in dealing with the 20th century media institutions. You know, a bad story about you on the front page of the Cedar Rapids Gazette would, you know, you'd say, okay, well, now we need to respond to it. But if it's on, you know, if it's just on page 19 of the Des Moines Register, there are probably not enough readers in our part of the state who are going to see it. So let's not draw attention to it, right? Or this talk radio host is making a big deal of this issue. You know, we probably don't have to worry about that. They don't reach our voters, but if this other host starts to get interested in this, we'll need to find a way to push back because that could be a problem. And this was just sort of a rule of thumb in you know, or 1,000 points on TV may you know merits one response, but 300 points means we do something very different. Nobody had any sense of how this applied to the internet, and people were so taken by the novelty of online narratives, both true ones and false ones, to move through the electorate that they were often felt, we just need to do something. And there was such a pressure, I think, in the sort of early Trump years among folks on the American left, such a desire to be active in, you know, the resistance to Trump, that people often erred on the side of action. And one of the issues with online disinformation is that can be precisely the wrong response. You know, you can draw attention to something that's not getting much attention, and it can reach a wider audience that way. The sort of structure of social media is often particularly wired to reward engagement. So if you try to fact check a post by your opponent and they, you know, you're feeding the algorithms that show engagement and want to share it, you know, show it to other people. And then I think, you know, most, there's a lot of cognitive science that suggests that if you try to debunk a lie, you can often, if you don't do it the right way, reaffirm it in the minds of people who hear it. And then I think the most complicated problem for campaigns is how to maintain your focus without getting constantly distracted by the new thing that's popping up. And the simple fact is, if you're a public figure or institution, and this is not just true of politicians, but it's true of celebrities and companies and brands and universities, nonprofits, anybody, people are going to be lying about you and the issues you care about online every day. And you have your own priorities to communicate, to raise money, to keep your staff or supporters or donors engaged. And if you spend all day just sort of responding to what's popping up on the internet, you will lose the ability to accomplish your own objectives. And so the Counter Disinformation Task Force of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, a lot of the other characters I'm writing about, are trying to teach candidates and political communicators how to understand when not to respond and why.
The interesting thing is, as I was reading your book, and as listeners know, I've been involved in politics in my career, and I know in the discussions and strategy sessions, as you said, you try to pick out issues where your candidate is vulnerable, and legitimate issues, voting records, things like that. This is a totally different beast where you go through and say, well, what lies could they tell? And it's just mind-boggling how can you even get your arms around that? I mean, it would cost an arm and a leg to go out and poll and say, well, if they said this, is this going to hurt us more than this lie? You see what I mean? Did you run into that type of thinking? And what are the limits for what they can do to try to inoculate themselves, or are there any?
Yeah, I mean, the most interesting project sort of on this front was something I wrote about the Biden campaign doing in 2020. And so, you know, they were blessed in the summer of 2020 with a couple of things that are, as you will know, Robin, from experience, unusual in campaigns, a fair bit of time, and as close to unlimited money as you're going to get in in campaign politics. And so I write about the digital director of the campaign, this guy, Rob Flaherty, who then went and did that job in the White House, is now the deputy campaign manager on the reelect. And he wanted to sort of embark on a big research project to define what he called market moving disinformation. What he said was the only disinformation online I care about is anything that is going to stop Joe Biden from getting to 50+1. That's our electoral goal. People are going to lie on the internet all day. Frankly, a lot of it will be stuff that Trump supporters create to amuse other Trump supporters. And that is not my worry unless it is either getting in front of persuadable voters and pushing them away from voting for Joe Biden, or getting in front of our supporters in a way that demobilizes or demotivates them. But anything else, it might be a concern for society, might be a concern for the platforms to deal with, but it's not my problem as a campaigner. And so they set out to, they did a big public opinion research project and generated a list of viral narratives about related to the Biden campaign that were circulating online. And this included, you know, a lot of times they use actually Trump's own shorthands to, because they were so useful to sort of describe these. So there was Sleepy Joe, the stuff about his age and his sharpness. Creepy Joe, we don't hear a lot about this one anymore. This was sort of the idea that Biden was too handsy with younger women. There were some things about Kamala Harris both being like a socialist and also being, you know, too much of a cop. And then they also actually included some that were, they created these, they call them red herrings. They were actually entirely false storylines. One was that Joe Biden was a member of an all-white country club, which is in fact in no way true. But they included him in the survey to sort of set a baseline. And some people say that they've heard these things, which had never actually circulated. But they asked, there's two central questions they wanted to know of the 8, 10, 12% of the voters who are persuadable. One, are you familiar with this storyline? And two, would it make you less likely to vote for Biden against Trump? And they mapped this on an axis. And so one axis was the storyline's reach, how many persuadable voters had heard about it. And the other axis was its impact, how likely it was to affect votes. And basically the campaign's judgment was only stuff that was in that top right corner was worth worrying about. And what they learned, for example, was that the stuff that related to Hunter Biden and the corruption allegations, it had a lot of reach. A lot of persuadable voters said that they were familiar with it. But they also said that it would be unlikely to affect their support for Biden. And focus groups revealed that it was because they didn't see Biden as fundamentally motivated by personal financial gain. So it just didn't really ring true to them. But the stuff that they called Sleepy Joe, that had both reach and impact. Persuadable voters said that it could affect their choice. And the focus groups revealed that that was not because they were actually concerned about Biden's physical fitness. They saw him as this fundamentally weak political figure. I think a lot of this probably has to do with having emerged nationally as vice president, being in the sort of president's shadow, winning the nomination in 2020, but never really being the main character of that primary season. And they weren't really sure what he would do in office and who would be calling the shots. They wondered, as one of his pollsters told me, that he wouldn't be the quote unquote author of his presidency. And that manifests itself in being open to these sort of concerns about his age, but they weren't really fundamentally worried about his age. And so the way that the communications team on the campaign had thought about this was, okay, let's deal with these age issues by setting up photo ops of Biden riding a bicycle. Let's have him run up the stairs to his plane. And this research project revealed like that was not really getting at what voters were worried about. And instead, they did things like, when people searched on Google for terms like Biden and senile, they would get pushed to seeing ads that were just like 15-second ads that showed Biden unedited talking about his views on economic policy to convince people that he had strong values and, you know, that he would act upon when he was in office. And that actually, the testing showed, was the thing that most assuaged their susceptibility to the concerns about his age. And so all that, Robin, is like to say that I think the smartest approaches to dealing with this disinformation stuff is not to be chasing individual pieces of content as they move online every day, but to think about what are the underlying concerns or anxieties that voters, citizens, shareholders, consumers, constituents have, and that would make them receptive to certain types of disinformation, and try to address those underlying anxieties and concerns rather than just chasing a given deep fake video or a lie or a conspiracy theory online.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson. My guest today is Sasha Eisenberg, who's the author of a new book called The Lie Detectives: In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in a Disinformation Age. We've been talking about several aspects of this. I wanted to throw this out because I know there's Republicans that are listening, both Trump supporters and more of the mainstream type Republicans, old maybe Reagan style Republicans. Is this what they would throw back to me when I have conversations is, well, both parties lie. Both parties always lie. They go back to Obama saying you can keep your doctor in the debate about Obamacare, LBJ. And you point out some examples where Democrats have used some of these things. Is this a level playing field, or is it going against one party or the other?
So I would sort of separate here the conversation about elites, about politicians or sort of public figures, media, and what sort of moves online, often anonymously or without clear origins. I do think that Trump has fundamentally changed the way that Republican elites think about truth, accuracy. I mean, I don't think they perceive the same penalty for being called a liar now that politicians once did. That usually was a huge restraint. I think if you had asked politicians, what is the thing that you would least want voters to hear about you, it would be that you're a liar. I think that has been thrown around so much, it sort of lost their weight, I think. And so I see Republican senators saying or posting things online, which are so disprovably false, it's hard to imagine that the equivalent 10 or 20 years ago, you would have heard. And so that's one thing I think from politicians where there is a real asymmetry. You look at just the way that Katie Porter, who just lost the primary for Senate here in California, the day after the election said that it had been rigged. And there was just an uproar among other Democrats about her using that term, and she later tried to couch it that she thought it was because lobbyists had given too much money to her opponent or something. But I do think that there is a way in which Democrats police and enforce sort of old norms about credible speech in a way that Republicans don't. And online, I tell the story of an effort that took place in 2017 in the special election for Senate in Alabama, where there were two separate false flag operations online that had been created by one by a group of sort of technologists who had been involved in the Obama campaigns and administration, another by a local activist in Alabama, that were designed to mislead Alabama voters into thinking that Roy Moore was getting support from, in one case, Russian intelligence services, and in another case by neo-prohibitionists who wanted to ban alcohol in certain Alabama counties, and entirely manufactured, entirely dishonest. And Hoffman's money had gone into both of these. And when it came out later how these things had worked, the blowback and claims of hypocrisy against Reid Hoffman, who on one hand was talking about in high-minded ways about how Trump was a danger to democracy, and part of that was because he diminished the value of truth, and at the same time, his money was going to fund these things, got him to say to sort of set a rule that, you know, he didn't want his money to be used for this. And it has stood as sort of the de facto line in Democratic politics, mostly because at that point in late 2018, just about everybody on the American left was either getting money from Reid Hoffman or wanted to get money from Reid Hoffman. That his saying that I don't want to be paying for things that mislead voters ended up serving as sort of a moral compass, inadvertent moral compass on this subject. And so I don't see the same efforts yet online among those on the left to sort of manufacture and intentionally spread lies the way we do among those on the right.
We've just scratched the surface of the book, and there's a part of this that you go globally, different places around the world where that are experiencing this as well. We won't have time to talk about that. I want to just conclude. We got about 2 minutes left, and this is try to limit you on a question like this.
Sorry.
But what the average citizen out there who's listening in and just going, I think my reaction. Good Lord, what can we do as average citizens, short of reading 50 papers a day, to sift through what's true and what isn't? Any ideas?
Yeah. So the first thing I would say is, one, remember that there's probably nothing you need to share online immediately that can't wait 5 or 10 minutes. So if something seems too good to be true, if it flatters your biases, if it says something sort of unbelievably bad about someone you or institution you dislike, or unbelievably good about someone you do like, pause, try to Google for a fact check and hope that a news organization has checked it. And I think most importantly, if you do find a fact check from a credible organization, PolitiFact, the Associated Press, Snopes, corrects something that's online, share that. One of the problems online is that bad information travels really quickly, and good information often doesn't. And so use your networks, the people who trust you online, to push out good information. So if you see something and you read a fact check that debunks it or gives you the necessary context, use your Facebook or Twitter account to share that with your friends and family, because so that they're getting good stuff pushed into their feeds as readily as the bad stuff reaches it.
Perfect. Okay, thanks for sharing that. Again, Sasha Eisenberg's been our guest today. He's the author of an important new book, The Lie Detectives: In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age. Again, Sasha also authored The Victory Lab, which I still use in my political science classes. It's excellent. It's about the science of winning campaigns and the ways data is used now in elections, which also plays a role in this book a little bit in setting the stage. So, Sasha, thank you so much for being my guest, and I look forward to having you back down the road.
Really appreciate it, and hope to see you in Illinois or Iowa sometime soon, Robin. Thank you.
I hope so.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.